Jesus washed.
Lord,
oh, when he washed.
Oh, when Jesus washed. When Jesus washed. Lord,
he washed my sins away.
My sins away.
how happy day. Oh, how happy day.
Ladies and gentlemen, my friend Miss Mavis Staples. How's everybody doing? Hello, Detroit. We're going to do something that Levi and I and the Tops did late one evening. Irma, Sandra, Margaret, over in the sound suite. And for those of you who can identify with this, just let me see you wave your hand. Give me that intro one more time. Male and female.
For the moon.
Oh, yes.
And fall amongst the stars.
And fall amongst the stars.
Rita, just let me be.
Ooh, yes.
Wherever you are.
You're going to be there.
Wherever you are.
You're going to be right there.
Oh,
listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, speaking to you from the Great White North. I'm no longer on the sunny West Coast. I'm in the Great White North, and we kick the show off with the music of Aretha Franklin, the preacher's daughter, and Theo Peoples, the preacher's son, and they did a song called I Want to Make It Up to You, and we kick the show off with Mavis Staples and Aretha Franklin doing Oh Happy Day. And this is still International Women's Month, and we have a very action-packed show for you today. We're going to be speaking with Ezeli Danto at 2:30 about the Haitian, the role that Haitian women played in the revolution. She's done a beautiful video that's on YouTube. We're going to talk about that. And we're going to talk about the UN, how they are continuing with their treacherous role on the cholera question in Haiti. We're also going to be paying tribute to Bobby Smith, who passed away. He was one of the founding members of the Spinners, and we're going to pay tribute to him. And we're going to have an interview with H.B. Barnum. That's going to be a very, very great interview with H.B. And we really thank you for listening. Next week we're going to be going into fundraising mode. But I would like to begin this show like I begin all my shows by thanking Omali Ishatella, Chairman Omali Ishatella, and Archie Shepp. Archie Shepp gave me the concept of Diasporic Music, and Chairman Omali Ishatella gave me the space to do Diasporic Music. And if you wanted to get a hold of us, you can email us at dj@uhururadio.com. The Skype option is Uhuru Radio, and the U.S. phone number, the North American phone number, is 727-565-1599. If you're calling from the United Kingdom, you can call 020-8133-6629. And we continue with the music of Sister Aretha Franklin.
So maybe, yeah. This is dedicated to who it may concern. Precious dream. To be young, gifted, and blessed. What I mean, to what I mean. Cause you know, in this whole wide world, we everything, yeah.
You are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Jalali, a.k.a. Norman Otis Richmond, speaking to you from Toronto, Canada. We have been paying tribute to women and musically, but we snuck a little Donny Hathaway in there. We had to play a little Donny Hathaway to be young, gifted, and black, but we were really listening to the music of Aretha Franklin, who turned 20. She turned 71 on the 25th of March. And joining me on the line from her home is Azili Danto, who is the a leading member of the Haitian Lawyers Leadership Network, which is based in New York City and in Haiti itself. And we wanted to discuss a number of issues with Azili. This is Women's History Month, and we know that women in Haiti played a major role in that particular struggle. Also, Azili has a very powerful video on YouTube. We wanted to talk about that. And we also wanted to talk about the UN and their negligence in the whole question of the cholera situation in Haiti. The UN has been asleep at the wheel on that particular issue. And I wanted to welcome Azili to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thank you very much for having me.
I guess the first thing we wanted to discuss is the role that women played in the Haitian Revolution. We know that women played a role in struggles everywhere, but a lot of people don't realize, when we talk about Haiti, we always talk about Dessalines, we talk about Toussaint, we talk about Christophe. And then, of course, people talk about Papa Doc and Baby Doc being on the wrong side of the question. But we never hear too much about women, and we really would appreciate to hear the role that the women played in the Haitian Revolution and continue to play today.
Absolutely. Folks, you know, whoever writes history tells about the winners, and we do have a patriarchal world. So I do spend a lot of my time lifting up the Haitian women who took up arms and fought alongside their men against chattel slavery, European chattel slavery. And I have a couple of pieces out there that folks can look at. I have a piece that you could Google that says, I think it's Jean-Jacques Dessalines, Haiti's founding father, and the women who influenced him. In that piece, for instance, I start out with Grand Toya. You know, Jean-Jacques Dessalines was born enslaved on a plantation, and on that plantation, he was raised by someone he called Aunt Toya, Grand Toya. And during his, as he was, you know, growing up, it was a woman who taught him how to fight in hand-to-hand combat. This is Toya. Her name is Toya. She taught him how to shoot, how to fight. And it's an amazing story because here is, you know, the founding father and the greatest warrior that did what Spartacus could not do, which is, in world history, have an enslaved people overthrow their enslavers, and he was taught how to fight by a woman. I think that every young girl should learn that story, and Grand Toya should definitely be elevated. Now, Grand Toya also, during the 13-year Great Revolution from 1791 to 1804, when we became the first black republic in this so-called New World, he gave her a place to stay. The whole, you know, after when, you know, the slavery ended, she came to live with him. She also had her own battalion, her own warrior battalion. So we talk a little bit about that. Also, for instance, Jean-Jacques Dessalines' wife, Marie-Claire Heureuse, is a really fascinating figure. She was a pacifist. She went out and picked up the wounded from both sides, from the French and from the African warriors. And everyone stopped the fighting for her to pick up the wounded and take care of them and bury them, or those who were still alive, provide them with healing. She was a great healer. Her name is Marie-Claire Heureuse, and in Haitian history, she is like the first, let's say, neutral party, the Red Cross. She had a group of followers, and this is what they did. And when they married, now here is the greatest hero who ever lived, who is the biggest enemy. I mean, to this day, the name of Jean-Jacques Dessalines is reviled by the Europeans. They will talk about Toussaint Louverture because, they killed him, and because, he stood for black-ruled French colony, and whereas Jean-Jacques Dessalines stood for black-ruled independent nation. So he was their worst nightmare. But here is his wife, the person he chose to marry, and she was a pacifist, and she forbid him to bring his weapons, which was his life. And he had enemies from inside, enemies from the outside, and certainly having taken the arms of the French, the Spanish, the English, and the French twice again. All of those folks and the black collaborators. He had all those folks trying to kill him. And here is his wife forbidding him to bring in weapons into their house. So it's a fascinating story, and a story that's not been told. And we talk about Marie-Claire Heureuse and who she was and what she was and what that means for the Haitian people. This two sort of dichotomy of the Rada in the Petro, the fiery warrior, and then this other energy that he married to. Another woman that's critically important in Haitian history, her name is Grande. She was an elder woman, and she was the spiritual advisor of Jean-Jacques Dessalines. Her name is Grande Guillotin. Now, if you all go to the latest piece you were just introducing with regards to the video of Esli Dancol's work, of our work at the Haitian Lawyers Leadership, you will see we tie in basically all of the work that I do, which is lifting up Haitian warriors, both men and women, and lifting up our history and our riches. And you'll see when I took the solar mothers, these four women that we just sponsored to India to learn how to become solar engineers, these are semi-literate women who, 6 months ago were coming down the mountains of their rural village in donkeys or in motorcycles, taxis, to go into market and then sell their wares. We took, these are the majority backbone. This is the informal economy of Haiti, and the women are small farmers, and they are market women. They are the ones that are taking care of their families, and they're the ones we center on in this project we have that's called Vili Blow, which is clean water, renewable energy, transfer of skills to Haiti. And in that process, one of the things that we did was we gave the information I'm giving to your listeners to these women. We brought them to Grande Guillotin's monument, her place, where she lived, and where Jean-Jacques Dessalines and the warriors who came to get strength from their African ancestors would come to Grande Guillotin. Now, her story is fascinating. She could never be held in chains, and the Europeans, stopped even trying to enchain her. She's a legend in Haitian history, and you won't hear and see about her in anywhere of the colonial narratives. But she actually...
Do they teach about her in Haitian history, in Haitian schools in the 21st century?
No. I mean, you see, Haitian history, one of the ways that we were recolonized was ecclesiastically after the Haitian Revolution. They came back with the priests and the education, and so Haitian history is taught through the prism of these priests. And so, of course, they're not going to elevate a Vodou woman.
Mm-hmm. I got you. I understand.
Yeah, no, and even you know, Haitian scholars, I mean, the rare scholar, you know, they're also schooled by the Europeans, and they have a prism that they look into, and so you won't really see much with respect to Glenn Guillotin, but today I have to say that there are other women like I, Haitians, who are elevating the women. And Glenn Guillotin, there is a woman named Baena Bello, Professor Bayo Bello. She has a foundation for Marie Claire Rouge, and fascinating stuff. So anyone who happens to go to Haiti should try to speak to Professor Bello and go to the Marie Claire Rouge Foundation, so you can get a different view of this warrior that everyone's so afraid of. Right here, he was married to a pacifist. It's a fascinating story.
When you finish, I have something I wanted to ask you.
Yeah. So if you look in our video, I mean, we choose a few women. For instance, Marie Jeanne, who was there's this greatest a good battle called Crête à Pierrot, and in that battle, the African warriors were outnumbered in great, great numbers. I mean, I think there were 5,000 to 7,000 warriors in a fort, isolated and surrounded by something like 10,000 French soldiers, and they managed to get out. And Marie Jeanne was there fighting alongside her husband. And it's a fascinating story of you know, we have people know about who Marie Jeanne is and how she fought at Crête à Pierrot, how, you know, they would not give up, and how they found a way through the ranks of the tenth of you know, they were outnumbered and outgunned, and she was there to keep all of the warriors encouraged, and they got out. And that's a beautiful story. There is one, I'll mention one more. Her name is Sanit Belair. She was a sergeant in the Revolutionary War. And, she was caught by the French. And, her husband was a general. He became a general at some point. Yes, he was a general. And, so he went to the French and he said, you know, I'll switch my life, you know, let my wife go and take me. And when they agreed, of course, and then betrayed him and took them both and put them to the firing squad. And as the French were killing Sanit Belair and her husband, they came to her after they had executed her husband and said, you know, since you're a woman, we'll put a blindfold over you. And she says, no, I'm a warrior. And this is like a really legendary, the courage of Sanit Belair is legendary in Haiti. And she just opened up her chest and said, come with it. And would not allow herself to be blindfolded.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just a few. I mean, we Défilé, for instance, had her own army, and she, when the French mulatto, the diaspora mulatto sons of France betrayed Dessalines and killed him, you know, everyone was scared because they had chopped up his body at Pont Rouge and so forth. And she was the courageous person who gathered up the members of Haiti's founding father and gave them a burial. And Défilé is always taught to be, you know, crazy. She was a crazy woman. But she you know, so we talk about Défilé. We give her honor. So those are the things. And we say that we cannot say the name of Jean-Jacques Dessalines without lifting up Défilé. And the great act of courage when all the warriors were standing back, and she walked right into the lion's den and took his body and went and gave him a funeral, and in that way lifted up our dignity. You know, folks have to understand that once the Haitian warriors had won, the indigenous army had won. I mean, to this day we are still fighting to push back the wrath of the rabid elites and their diaspora Afanchi sort of minds that believe that civilization is European.
Well, let me say that I saw two films at the Pan-African Film Festival. One was on Toussaint Louverture, and one was called 1802, about rebellion in Guadeloupe. And the women were unbelievable in both of those particular films. And I remember this is sort of there was a press conference once years ago, and Don Cheadle and Denzel Washington had just done a film, and I asked Denzel Washington if he had his choice to play anyone in the Haitian Revolution. Would he play Christophe? Would he play Toussaint Louverture? Would he play Dessalines? And he looked and he laughed. He said, if I had my choice, I would play Dessalines. That was his response.
Of course. Well, there goes a very knowledgeable man.
Yeah. Yeah, he said if he had it, if it was his choice, he would play Dessalines. Could we move on? I think we should talk about the women more, but we can bring you back another time, and
no problem. What do you want to?
We can do another show, a whole half an hour, just on the women. But I wanted to talk about your video that you did on YouTube, because I think that is people need to see that. So I would like for you to, you know, give
them. Well, it actually fits very well into the conversation of the meaning of the female energy, and how African women would rather have their children not live than to be put into chattel slavery. You know, Haiti's women are its backbone. And so if you look at the work that I do, you know, I come from a lineage of warrior women. So my work is about that. It's about who and what we are. So the recent video that folks can find on my website at ezelidanto.com/Zili, or you can just put Zili's work or Ezeli Danto's work on YouTube and you'll see it. I think I put it up March 24th or something like that very recently.
You did put it on YouTube, and a lot of people, I sent it out, and it's been a lot of people have reposted it, right?
Oh, fantastic, fantastic! Because you know, I've been at this for more than 20 years, and I feel my energy just the fight is constant. So, it would be good for folks to pick up that and see some of the stuff that you won't find anywhere else. Because the white boys basically, you know, corner the media, and you know, they corner the media, the fundraising, all the air in the room, because they just hoard. They are the saviors, obviously. So but in that video, for instance, you know, we talk about the revolutionary female heroes, but you see the picture of Sonia Thiers, who just passed away but last year, but she led a Herculean fight in the Dominican Republic for decades against the ill treatment and practical enslavement of Haitians in the sugarcane factories and so forth, and Bataille. So we have women right now who are fighting alone and without any sort of recognition. And, you know, so I definitely must lift up the name of Sonia Pierre. In this video, it's... we have a project of the Haitian Lawyers Leadership Network, which is called Zili Plo, and that's the waters of Guinea. Really, it's life and health for Haiti. That's basically what Zili Plo is. Zili Plo is a project of the Haitian Lawyers Leadership that we started by necessity, not because, you know, we wanted to get into the humanitarian relief work business. But what happened was that. After the cholera, I mean, we were always giving some sort of relief in addition to doing the legal advocacy work of the Haitian Lawyers Leadership Network and talking about the non-colonial narrative, as I say, with regards to, you know, lifting up Haitian women, with regards to lifting up Haiti's riches. In this video, all of it comes together. We lift up Haiti's riches, we lift up Haiti's women, and we lift up this project, this humanitarian project of clean water, solar energy, renewable energy, let's say, and transfer of skills. What we wanted to show is that here is a model of what relief with human rights and dignity is about. When the earthquake happened on January 12, 2010, 316,000 human beings were lost in 33 seconds. And on that day at 4:53, I knew that they were going to let our people die, because that's the whole point of the U.S. occupation behind the U.N. humanitarian frauds in Haiti right now. It's basically to take the land, clean it out of its all of its billion year of resources that's in Haiti. Haiti is the oldest landmass in the Americas. It is a volcanic eruption of magnitudes in terms of the minerals that's in those mountains. You know, folks say that, you know, it's mountains after mountains in Haiti. And so you have all of these riches, you know. Finally, the U.S. Mining companies, now that they have their puppet government, have acknowledged that there's $20 billion worth of gold that they're now, you know, but they've been cutting it off. Haitian geologists have said, and this is what we said in 2004 when they deported President Aristide, the first democratically elected president to Haiti, back to Africa, when they did that on the bicentennial, and that's what brought, I was doing other things, and that brought me here in 2004, woke up Dantal, in essence. And that's another woman, of course, Cécile Fatimine and Esme Dantal. You all can just look that up on my website and you see what that means. But so this video puts together, for instance, you know, we took four women who were semi-literate or illiterate, and they lived in remote villages in Haiti, Ocaden-Saint-Baptiste, which is not very far from Port-au-Prince, but they are the, you know, 70 to 80% of Haiti is peasant farmers. That's what it is. You know, it's not, you know, the Republic of NGOs in Port-au-Prince, where all the white folks go and all the so-called charity folks go and take pictures of orphans and say, you know, and come and pull the heartstrings of Americans and goodwill people from all over the all the races and say, you know, help this little orphan. You know, women, Black women in Haiti are the backbone, keeping Haiti going, have been the backbone for two centuries now against the most overwhelming odds. And they live in these remote villages. We took these four women. We sent them with the help of Barefoot College and the government of India to become solar engineers, solar technicians, so that they could come back 6 months later. They just came back on the 17th of March. They left in September. And so that video tells that story. And in that story, as we orientated these women, who really, you know, for instance, you know, they might have lived right next to the house of Glen Guillotin, but because the Europeans do not elevate Haitian culture and Haitian riches, they never even thought to go and see what's in there. So we brought them to Glen Guillotin's house. We showed them the 300 years of ancestral govies, the remains, and the spirit, and what it was about for Glen Guillotin, and how her descendants are maintaining her legacy in Haiti. We brought them to, you know, the fort. There's a fort that was next to Ocaden, the other area that we chose, and so that they can see, for instance, you know, how our warriors fought. That, you know, they didn't have any guns, and so it was, you know, when they won and took over a French ship or a Spanish ship or an English ship, that's when they would have guns. They would then, and you see on the floor, and you see the pictures, if you go to the video, of these various cannons that, you know, some of them with the name of some queen of England, and another one with the French name. You know, that's what they used to win the Haitian Revolution. And so we brought these women to these places, these remains of our ancestors, these monuments in Haiti's riches. So that, and so you'll see that. You'll see, for instance, there's a mountain called Massif de la Route, which has fauna and flora and reptiles and different animals that are found nowhere else on this planet. And so those riches are some of the reasons why we have all sorts of scientists in Haiti, but they hide Haiti's riches. And so our job is to lift up Haiti's riches and say that, you know, those 10,000 UN troops and 50,000 Americans in Haiti in the time of cholera, in the time of Clorox hunger, in the time of people dying just from not having clean water, are not there in any ways to help the poor. As a matter of fact, you know, the proof to that is that $9 billion was collected for earthquake relief. And
Izzy,
the New York Times,
I don't want to cut you, but we only have 5 minutes, and
yep.
I definitely wanted you to talk about the UN and the cholera, how they are implicated. Are they part of the problem and not part of the solution on the cholera question?
Absolutely, yes. So really, it all fits in because in that video, we show what's the solution. The solution to cholera is clean water. The solution to Haiti's problem is providing skills transfer directly to Haitians, not paying salaries and pharmaceutical goods and produce from abroad and killing the Haiti farmers' own produce. So that's really what that story is that you will find in the video. Now, Zumi Blo provides a small, tiny example of clean water. We have that with the women in Haiti that we are supporting, the grassroots women that we're supporting, are giving, you know, clean water to their families. And you see the beneficiaries. You see that the one man who actually helped us, because on January 13th and 14th, I was calling all of people I could think of, the African-American intelligentsia with some sort of connection to power, to say they will let our people die. And the person that heard our call, because we put out a 14-point plan for relief for Haiti. And the one person took that plan and actually, you know, helped us. Endorsed it was Minister Farrakhan, and he helped us with our clean water project and helped purchase a filtering system that the women in Haiti now are using. So, what we try to do is not only, you know, advocate by showing the non-colonial narrative on Haiti, by showing that this is a U.S. occupation behind U.N. guns, that the U.N. is just covering up the pillage and plunder of Haiti. Haiti's resources, Haiti's oil, folks know, is like Haitian geologists say, is a Olympic pool compared to Venezuela's cup of water. And you should all know that Venezuela has the biggest cache reserve of oil in the Western Hemisphere.
Right,
so that's
correct.
Why they're there. And so that's what the video is about. It is about the work that we do. It talks about the cholera. You'll see, for instance, that since October 10th, 2010, the U.S., the U.N. brought in cholera to Haiti. Haiti had never had cholera. And to date, over 8,000 poor Haitians have died. Over 650,000 Haitians have been infected. Our water, our crops, our, you know, everything, you know, for the poor that maintains Haiti has been negatively affected, of course. And recently, the UN just claimed that it is not liable legally for this damage. And so I would like to say that the last thing I'd like to do in this career as a lawyer is to file a lawsuit against the UN in a U.S. federal court. Now, since the beginning, we've been at the forefront of exposing the UN, and I dare say that if we hadn't been out here pushing that, who knows if we would have gotten to this point, because all of the scientists, the CDC, the Harvard folks, you know, at the very beginning when they were caught, right, when the UN was caught red-handed with its lies about not bringing in cholera and, were basically, you know, enabling the UN with Paul Farmer talking about, and CDC talking about that the source doesn't matter. We just have to try to not make it endemic. Well, they haven't done anything. Hey, the cholera outbreak is killing Haitians left and right. In the meanwhile, while this environmental importation of bacteria has killed so many in the same way that, you know, when Columbus came to Haiti, they killed the Tainos with all sorts of diseases. Well, that's what they're doing now. And it's deeper than that, because the garbage of modern man that has been brought up onto this country is destroying Haiti slowly, slowly, the population now. Because in contrast, you have the first Best Western Hotel. You have, like, luxury hotels for foreigners, like, being built for the first time in Haiti in the time of cholera. So,
That makes absolutely no sense, does it?
That really shows you what this is about, what this occupation
right.
is about.
Right.
You see, because open pit mining is happening with the 20,000 with 20 billion in gold. Open pit mining, when you already have cholera. And so when you already have these global warming and hurricanes that are destroying cities, they're taking down the mountains, which is natural barrier against some of these winds and so forth. So they don't really care about
the people,
the black folks. And so that's where we are. And I encourage anyone who's interested in helping us, please. We're looking for a law firm who has a war chest, who has ability to hire experts to come and stand with us and say, you know, the Haitian Lawyers Leadership is enough, and we have a narrative. And because we believe this is a wrongful death, let's say we just say it's wrongful death, it's not biological warfare, the place to go is right in the belly of the beast, at least to elevate this what's happening, the international crime that is in Haiti.
Well, let me say one thing. Next week we are raising funds on Diasporic Music on Uhura Radio, and if you have a few minutes, if you could spend maybe 2 minutes with us raising some funds, because we would like to continue to talk to people like you on Diasporic Music, and you know, there's people are being shut out of radio. KPU out of San Francisco is in trouble. Washington D.C. the stations in Washington D.C. so-called Pacifica stations are, you know, being sold to Clear Channel. So we really would like for you to come and help us on Diasporic Music, if that's possible, with your permission.
I would be more than honored, because without, you know, radio such as yours, Norman, Diasporic, this program, our voice would never be heard. We're not getting any, it's like we don't exist. You know, the people that exist for Haitian work is, you know, Sean Penn, Clinton. I mean, it's like Haitians.
Sean Penn, he's the savior, right?
he's definitely, you know, the savior, you know. So yes, I would encourage all the listeners to support this sort of alternative radio, because without it, the mainstream media is corporate-owned, embedded, and you would not hear. I mean, if you found any of what I'm saying empowering, then I would love to do that.
All right, so we have to get off of these airwaves, because time is up, but I appreciate it, and I thank you for spending this half an hour. I think we went over a little bit, but that's no problem. We will talk to you next week, and we'll see you in the whirlwind.
That's right. EzliDelphel.com/Zili. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And we have been speaking with Azili Danto, and we are going to be paying tribute right now to Bobby Smith of the Spinners.
Get no rest, don't know how I work all day. When will I learn? Memories get in the way. I walk around, I can't hear a sound, folks talking loud, but I don't see at all.
I gotta get away, gotta get away. I don't
know where to go. It's hopeless, so I guess I'll leave it alone.
Well, I spent all that day fixing up to go somewhere. Thought I was late, and I found she wasn't there. I guess I'll find love, peace of mind some other time, but I still have today. I gotta get away, gotta get away. I don't
know where to go. It's hopeless, so I guess I'll leave it alone.
Kings people play night or day, they're just not matching what they should do. Keep me feeling blue. Too long, right, wrong, I just can't stop it. Spending all day thinking just of you.
$12:45,
headed for the subway home.
Oh, I took my time,
'cause I felt so all alone.
Not far away,
I heard a funny sound. Took a look around and I
could see her face.
Smile as she came calling out my name. So I
nowhere to go. We'll take it slow. I guess I'll call it a day.
Games people play night or day, they're just not matching do.
Keeps me feeling blue.
Been down too long, right, wrong, I just can't stop it. Spending all day thinking just of you.
Sound, took a look around and I could see her face. Smile as she came calling out my name. So I
nowhere to go. We'll take it slow. I guess I'll call it a day.
Games people play night or day, they're just not matching what they should do. Can't stop it, spending all day thinking just of you. Games people play night or day, they're just not matching what they should do. Keep me feeling blue.
5:40.
And you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. And we were listening to the Spinners. We're paying tribute to Bobby Smith, who joined the Ancestors recently. He was 76. He passed away in Orlando, Florida, where he was living. But Bobby Smith was born in Georgia and grew up in Detroit and was an original member, a founding member of the Spinners, along with Pervis Jackson, Billy Henderson, and Henry Frambro. Henry Frambro is still in the land of the living. He's the last spinner alive. And Bobby Smith was a big influence on myself. I used to sing in groups, and I used to sing all of Bobby's songs. I'll Always Love You, That's What Girls Are Made For. I used to sing those songs, and there was a talent show once at Los Angeles City College, And if I get the story right, I believe it was organized by Al Prentice Bunchy Carter, who later became the Minister of Defense of the Southern California chapter of the Black Panther Party. But Al Prentice Bunchy Carter was a poet, and at that particular talent show, people that participated in that talent show were people like Sagidi Abdullah, who went on to produce the SOS band, Baby Take Your Time, Do It Right. Sagidi was a part of that particular talent show. Also part of that particular talent show was Earl Randall, who wrote he went on to work with Al Green and Willie Mitchell in Memphis, Tennessee. He was at that talent show. He went to school with us. Also Dar Malik L. Bay, a.k.a. Ronji Southern. He played the guitar for me when I sang my particular song, a Bobby Smith song. And also Masai Kariga Kenyatta, Fred Gorey, who went on to be a part of the Reverend Clegg's Christian Nationalist Church in Detroit, Michigan. He was a part of that particular, he was at that particular talent show. So, LACC, that took place at LACC, and we had a lot of talent at that particular time, and Bobby Smith and the Spinners were really very, very popular among a lot of us, and we continue our tribute to Bobby Smith of the Spinners.
You're breaking my heart, taking my sunshine away, knowing that I'm to blame. Darling, there's nothing that I can say. Darling, I've got to try, 'cause in my heart I know that I'll always love you. I'll always love you, baby. Darling, you're my love, no matter where you
what you say. Now I found out today, love, the words had slipped away. But I know there's always a chance. Time is what will remain. Yeah, and sparks turn into flames, and love can burn once again. But I know you know, whenever you call me, I'll be there. Whenever you want me, I'll be there. Whenever you need me, I'll be there. I'll be around.
Thank you.
And you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. We're paying tribute to Bobby Smith of the Spinners, one of the founding members of the Spinners, and we heard him sing "That's What Girls Are Made For," "I'll Always Love You," and "I Think I'll Be Around." But Bobby Smith, the Spinners were really created by Harvey Fuqua. Harvey Fuqua was the man who was a founding member of the Moonglows. He discovered Marvin Gaye. He really helped Etta James, and he's like an unsung hero of black music. And I mentioned Sagidi Abdullah before, and Dar Malik El Bey. We actually auditioned for Marvin Gaye and Harvey Fuqua in Los Angeles as a young man. We auditioned for Motown, and we actually made the cut, but we were Uncle Sam, the war in Vietnam came, and we were split up, and some of us, like myself, disappeared. Others went to Vietnam, but the group was broken up. But Harvey Fuqua founded Bobby Smith, Purvis Jackson, who is no longer in the land of the living, the bass singer, Henry Frambro, who is still alive, and Billy Henderson. And at that time, they had a lot of other lead singers. And at one point, they had a G.C. Cameron, the great G.C. Cameron, who sang "It's a Shame." But one of the men who really put the Spinners on the map was Felipe Wynn. Felipe Wynn was spent some time in Mexico and in Cincinnati. He actually lived in Europe and sang with African bands. And if you go back and watch the film, The Rumble in the Jungle with Ali, the fight between Ali and George Foreman, Felipe Wynn really shines. He really shines in that particular video. But we're going to play one last song by the Spinners, and this features Bobby Smith is singing in the background, but the lead vocalist on this is Felipe Wynn, and this is How Could I Let You Get Away, which was the flip side of the Spinners' first single on Atlantic Records. And the Spinners were brought to Atlantic Records by Aretha Franklin, and this is Bobby Smith, Felipe Wynn, Purvis Jackson, and the Spinners.
Laughing at you too. I like basketball, 5,000 that was on the games you really knew. Why couldn't I beat you in the middle of the room? Got no time to count my sheep today. Don't you run away. You wind me up, then you turn me loose. My chin was beaten too, and I can't tell green from blue, baby. I like cat and mouse, games of chase instead of house. I get so mad at you, like parents often do. I'm in the middle of the room. Somebody soon. Ooh, 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 ooh.
Here tonight, that everything would be real mellow like a cello of love. Yeah, I can imagine that he might say, "Baby, I love you, 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 I love you." Oh, for sentimental reasons. Was here, it'd be a different story altogether. The first thing Otis might say is, "Hey, come on, get your go, 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 got to help me, baby. Oh, baby, you got me sitting on the dock of the bay. I got to watch your girl get the way don't go in. I got to hold you one more time and see I'm going, go. Come on, baby. You too. Oh, but right now I just want the band to bring it on down, bring it down, bring it down. Oh. Hey, I've been trying to talk to you. You don't know me now, but I want you to love me. Every time I try to do the song like somewhere else. A little voice girl in my life. Something that my daddy told me long time ago. Yeah. But when you want to do it for yourself, you don't need no body. Ask the people to clap their hands. Won't you help me?
You are definitely listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, speaking to you from Toronto, Canada. and we are paying tribute to Bobby Smith of the Spinners. And on that particular song, that was led by Felipe Wynn. Felipe Wynn and Bobby Smith was singing, doing his background vocals. And we are going to miss Bobby Smith, and we're going to miss, the Spinners are still in existence, and a lot of the groups, traditional groups, only have one member still alive, the Shylights. I think Marshall of the Shylights is still there. The Blue Lovett of the Manhattans is still there. Otis Williams of the Temptations is still there, and it's kind of frightening, because vocal groups are a very big part of the African experience in the Western Hemisphere. We have vocal groups in North America, and Jamaica had a lot of vocal groups, and in South Africa you had vocal groups, but it is looks like it's a dying art form, and whatever we can do to keep the group thing alive, I think we should figure out something to keep our groups together. But right now we wanted to present an interview with a young man by the name of H.D. Barnum, out of Los Angeles, California, a real veteran of the music industry. And H.B. Barnum is a pianist, an arranger, a record producer, and a child actor. H.B. Barnum was with Aretha Franklin for about 20-some years. He was the conductor of her band and was the arranger for her group. He worked with everyone from the singers from the Nation of Islam to Francis Albert Sinatra. And right now we want to present an interview that we did with H.B. Barnum in his home in Los Angeles, California. This is myself interviewing H.B. Barnum.
Record producer, songwriter, and a former child actor. And you also have a choir. And I wanted to start off by talking about H.B. Barnum and what H.B. Barnum is doing in the 21st century. I have been coming to the choir rehearsals with a life choir. And how important is that to your work today in the 21st century?
Oh, that's my what do you call it, my Achilles heel. That's my life. I spend a lot of time with the choir. I love the choir. That's what I do. That's how I stay sane.
Now, last night you had a group of women from Mongolia, and I know you have some contacts with people in Poland. You are born in Texas and grew up in California. But as long as I've known you, I've always known you to be an international man. How did you hook up that world thing?
I'm just lucky. I have a lot of referrals. I have artists in Germany and Poland and Hawaii and Mongolia and Japan. I mean, I've been able to travel to all these places. So I just meet people and they refer other people and I wind up with their clients.
Now, you were have worked with Lou Rawls, Count Basie, O.C. Smith, Frank Sinatra, The Supremes, The Temptations, Aretha Franklin, Little Richard, Gladys Knight, Al Wilson. And is there anybody I've left out?
Well, you left out a lot of people. The thing is, I'm making a T-shirt up right now, and there's over 800 names on it that I've worked with and had a pleasure to work in. You left out like the OJs and the Temps and the Tops and the Supremes and Gladys Knight and the Martha Vandellas, Don Ho, Ernie Ford, K-Star, Pat Boone. There's a lot of them. I've had a good clientele of people that I've had a chance to work with, opportunity to write for and write with. And so it's been a lot of fun. I've had a good time.
Now, you work with the, oh, I know one thing you sent me one time, or someone sent me a long time ago, you did a something called the Fish Song on Salam Records.
One of the Muslim Brothers, that's right.
Uh-huh. How did that come about?
Well, you know, I have a lot of friends who are in the nation, and they were trying to put a project together, and they came to me, and I put it together for them. I don't even remember the Fish Song, but I remember the Fish Song, but I don't remember how it goes or anything.
I have it on 45.
You got a rare record, man.
Yeah, it's the Fish Song. But you know, I think I know you work with the OJs because when the OJs, you've been on Unsung talking about the OJs, Lou Rawls, and other artists. But you work with Walter, Eddie, and I guess
well, there were five guys when they first came.
Massey, yeah,
I cut the first things on them: Bobby Massey, Bill Iles, Eddie LaVert, Walter Williams, and William Powell.
William Powell.
Yeah, that's right. Powell. See, you know better than I do. Yeah.
No, I don't know. William was a light-skinned guy who had the pretty voice.
Yeah, that beautiful voice. That's right.
Did you produce Oh, How You Hurt Me, Girl?
Yes, Oh, How You Hurt Me, Girl. But our first song was a song called Lonely Drifter.
I remember Lonely Drifter.
Yeah, that was the first song.
Lonely Drifter was a song everybody... That was Walter singing bass. It sound...
That's right, yeah.
And Walter... But Walter could sing bass all the way up to
he could jump three or four octaves. Yeah, Walter's got a very unusual voice.
Yeah, they came out of Cleveland and came here and stayed with you for quite a while.
Actually, they came out of Akron.
Akron.
And then they stayed with me. They personally lived with me about a year. But they stayed in California about 5 years. And then they kind of, a couple of guys left the group. And then he went back to Ohio, and they were fortunate enough to run into Gumbel Huff. Mm-hmm. And a whole new career, and a great career started.
Right. Now, you also work with one of my other favorite singers. You work with the Vibrations, and you did a song, Hully Gully. You didn't do Hully Gully, but Peanut Butter was...
Yes, I worked with the Vibrations prior to them going to Cliff and Fred. But they did the Hully Gully, and then we came out and did a parody on it called Peanut Butter. And actually, Peanut Butter has outlived Hully Gully. Yeah.
Is Michelle Obama talking about doing something with that?
We're very optimistic about her putting that in her campaign of healthy foods. And of course, if you have healthy foods, peanut butter is one of the healthiest foods known to man. So we're hoping that we can make a connection there.
In terms of, you worked as an arranger for Capitol Records. You did, well, forgot to mention, you did that the last CD or the last album of Little Willie John. That's like a legendary album.
One of the greatest singers of our generation. And I had a much troubled life, but boy, can he sing. And I was fortunate enough to be a friend of his and very instrumental in cutting that last project that he did.
And you did Just Let Me... I mean, the song he did that... Never I think Johnny H. did it first. Uh-huh. Never Let Me Go, then I think The Impressions cut it, and Luther Vandross...
Cut it, and I cut it with a girl named Sharon Cash that I'll share with you who tore it up. Great song.
I never heard that one. And what was it like working with Willie John?
Well, we had a very short window. This is all public record anyway. He was incarcerated at the time, and I was able through some of my political friends to have him released in my custody to cut this particular product with Dave Anselrod, Capitol Records. But the thing is, though, he disappeared on us. It took off, and I had to go down and get him in Florida and bring him back because I was on the hook for a lot of money, bail. But we got it back, and he cut the whole album in about 9 hours. We had a window of a weekend, and by him disappearing for one day and a day and a half, so we only had about 9 hours to cut the album because he had to go back into the penal institution.
In Washington.
Yes,
Washington
in
State.
Right, yes.
Now, I wanted to go back in terms of you singing with the Robins, who later became the Coasters. Or could you talk about your just I want to talk about you as a just you as a singer.
Well, first of all, I'm not a singer, but people thought I could sing. I think back in the, and I can't say 50s or 60s, I'm only 21 years old. But back in the day, everybody wanted to be in a group. And I was like everybody else, I wanted to be in a group. I was with the Medallions and with the Robins and with the Dutones and with a couple of the groups who never got out of the woodwork. We were fortunate with the Robins. We had a couple of good hits.
Robins,
I wasn't on that. That was Carl Gardner, Billy Guy, Terrell Leonard, and Billy Richards, and Roy Richards. I got with them when we got to the Gene Norman area, the Cherry Lip area. Although when I went with the group, we didn't have a record contract, and I did all of Carl's leads. You know, I did Ride Somebody Number 9. I did Loop de Loop Mambo and Smokey Joe's Cafe. I did lead all the songs when I was with the group.
Mm-hmm.
So and at the time, you know, there were a couple of labels just being formed here. Dutone Records, of course.
Dutone, that was in Los Angeles.
That's right. And then my uncle Jack Lauderdale had a label too. He had Lil Lester Phillips and Mel Williams, Handsome Mel Williams.
Handsome Mel, right.
That's right. And Mel Walker.
Right.
And so I was around the music all the time. That wasn't my aspiration, but I was around all the time.
Now, you basically, after the Robins, you begin to, you were always in leading bands, but you as an arranger, did you start arranging at Capitol Records or before Capitol Records?
Well, actually, I probably was arranging all the time because everything we recorded with all those groups, I was the person to put it all together. I didn't know what the term arranger meant at that time. I just was the guy to put it all together. So I had a job, a brief stint on the job in between leaving the groups. But I was on the road all the time, you know, with different bands, with Chuck Higgins and Frank, Marvin and Johnny, Lil Richard, Fats Domino. I went out with Etta James, I was out with the Five Keys, the Royals, Bobby Lester and the Moon. I was out with all these groups because I would either be singing in the group or playing for the group or playing on the show band or something. So I was on the road constantly. So the arrangement was just kind of a natural thing. I was able to put everything together.
I have an anthology by the Temptations, and they did a rendition of Old Man River, which I had never heard before. It's the one that you arranged. It's on their, I think, on their one of their box sets.
Yeah, I worked off and on with Motown for 14 years. So I was there. I was there that David Jackson walked in. You know, I remember Supremes first started, four girls, not three. And so I worked with Motown a long time. I was fortunate to work with two of the great arrangers, Paul Reiser and Dave Van De Pete. And between the three of us, we cranked out everything probably from 1960 up until almost to the 80s. But I physically was with the label for 14 years. And after that, I just did piecemeal stuff, you know.
Well, Motown, I always thought that Brenda Holloway was, the people from Los Angeles, everybody associate Detroit with Motown. But you had yourself, you had Gloria Jones, you had Blinky Williams.
Uh-huh.
Who are some of the other people that come out of Los Angeles that made Motown?
I used to go to Detroit for 2 weeks every month. I did that for 14 years. I would spend 2 weeks in Detroit, 2 weeks in L.A. because I was with Capitol and RC, and I was also with Motown. And so most of the Motown artists that I did were there. And then when Jimmy Webb came out here, he was signed to Motown.
Mm-hmm.
And Ron Miller, who wrote For Once in My Life,
right.
That's when I began to do more stuff in Los Angeles. We did most of it in Hitsville and Motown, and at the old Grand Studio, West Grand Studio. So I spent a lot of time. I spent 2 months. I had a residence in Detroit, you know. So I would be there 2 weeks. I'd come out here for 2 weeks. Back 2 weeks. Here for 2 weeks.
I never realized that. So you, arranging for everyone from, did you arrange for Puff P. Diddy or, I know you work with
I did, even, we did the Grammys with P. Diddy. I did a piece that he and Stevie and Blue did a tap dance one, and I wrote that for them.
Mm-hmm.
And then I did some subsequently, I did some of the tracks for them.
So you work with everyone from Frank Sinatra to P. Diddy.
Frank Sinatra to whoever there is. I mean, I've been fortunate. I have a lot of good clients.
In terms of working with Frank Sinatra, my father always thought Frank Sinatra was I shouldn't say my father, but Marvin Gaye, Miles Davis, great Frank Sinatra as the greatest singer. I don't, but that's just my personal opinion. What is it about Sinatra that makes him so popular?
I think for me, in the musical side, Frank was the great interpreter of lyrics. He made you forget the voice and all that stuff. I mean, the music will always be beautiful. When you got Ralph Carmichael and Nelson Riddle and Billy May, you're going to have beautiful music.
Mm-hmm.
Those are great, great arrangers. But Frank was able to interpret a song. He could take the lyrics and make you really believe it happened. So forget about whether he had the greatest voice or all that. That's not important. He made you believe the song. And that was so important. On the human side, he's one of the nicest people that I ever knew. And people talked about him a lot. And my experience with him, that he was just a real gentleman. And I relate this story. It's a short story. We had just finished the session. It was the first session I did with him. And the essence of the session, he walked in, and somebody said, "This is the new kid." He said, hi, HB, I know your name. And I said, "Hi, Mr. Sinatra." He said, "Call me Frank." He came in. We did 3 takes on the song. He said, "That's fine. That's fine." He left. Now, that's the only time I had met him. About 4 months later, the comedy store was just getting started, and Richard Pryor was going to be that night, and asked us all to come down and cheer for him. So,
year was this, you remember?
Oh, I don't remember the year, but Frank was with Mia Farrow, so that you kind of
right.
Year. So we were sitting at the table. A lot of guys knew I had done a session with Frank, you know, and it was a big thing, you know. So all of a sudden, he walked in with Mia Farrow. So I said, "Hey, man, this is not you. Go talk to him." Well, I don't really know him that well at this point. I said, "Well, I don't want to bother him. You know, I don't want to get embarrassed, you know, go up there. Who are you, you know?" So they sit down across the room, he and Mia. They sit down, and some other actor came on, and he got up from the table, and I think he was going to the restroom or something, but he's walking toward our table, and he's coming over this way. Now, I'm really embarrassed because I don't know how to say, "Hello, Mr. Nigel," Frank, you know, because everybody thinks I'm really tight with Frank, and I just met Frank, you know. He walks up to me and says, "Hi, HB, how you doing, man?" I said, "I've been missing you. We got to get together more often." Man, my stock went up 9,000 points. And I mean, that takes class, you know. So whatever they said about Frank, they can't say it to me. He was always perfect. I mean, after that, you know, it was a beautiful relationship. That was beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
He's a real, real good guy.
You know, I had the pleasure of meeting Count Basie. And Count Basie had done a song with Paul Robeson. I think lyrics were written by Richard Wright. It was about King Joe. And I think Jimmy Rowe, Big Note, Jimmy Rushing, Mr. Five by Five, kept the time for Paul when he was singing a song about King Joe. Mm-hmm. I found Count Basie to be one of the very down-to-earth human beings. What did you do with them?
We worked together. I never played in the band. We did 30 shows together over my lifetime. You know, where I was on the show, and his band would be on the show, and I did. That's how Marshall Royal became one of my mentors. You know, Basie was a taskmaster. There were about 8 or 9 guys that I see as a musician. If you played with any one of those bands, you became a musician. You might have been able to play when you went in, but you were a musician when you came out. And that was Basie, Harry James, Ellington, Sartre Finnegan Band, Spike Jones. These guys knew how to take talent and make you become a musician. Because, you know, playing notes is one thing. But playing those notes making them sound good, that's another thing.
Mm-hmm.
And Basie was one of those guys. You know, people don't forget how great a piano player he was. You know, he was jazz in the field, as was Nat Cole. But, you know, these guys forget that they were just great musicians, too, that did other things. Basie became famous for his band. But he was a great piano player. So all the stride stuff, you know, all the Joplin stuff, all the. I mean, he basically played. and a taste master, you know. Not too much nonsense. I mean, he was loose, but he was for business, you know.
right.
And you can appreciate that. Yeah.
Now, I saw you recently on Unsung dealing with Lou Rawls. You were with Lou Rawls from the beginning. I remember seeing...
I won't say the beginning, because prior to me working with Lou, he worked with Les McCann and with Ozzy Matthews, two great musicians. Lou and I came together by chance. I happened to be walking in the Capitol Day. He was walking out. And we knew each other, but not, you know, now we had good buddy, like that. You know, we just had run each other at different clubs and stuff. And he was down, a little despondent, because they had just dropped him from the label. Well, they had just signed my lifelong friend, Dave Axelrod, as a producer. So I said, they can't do that. And I said, Dave will cut you again. He said, no, they just dropped me. I said, well, come on, let's go back upstairs. And Dave asked me, are you crazy? They just dropped it. This is my first year. I'm going to cut him again. Well, Dave did cut him. And from then it was history. Dave cut that live album. Then we did the, you know, Love and Hurtin' thing. Then we did, you know, Dead End Street. You know. So it was a happy meeting in the elevator. Lou was the cheapest guy I ever knew in my life. In fact, we parted company because he was so cheap. Not me. I'm not saying negative. I'm just saying he was cheap. He never picked up a tab when we went to lunch. He never bought your Christmas present, nothing like that. one of the greatest singers and interpreter of lyrics that there ever was. I mean, first of all, his voice had identification. He opened his mouth, you know, it's Lou, you know. And take a song and just beautifully, any kind of song, you know. Could snap on time and could put you in a groove that you wouldn't want to get out of, you know. But Lou, in fact, the house I'm in now, Lou's son, when he was 5 years old, ran through my plate glass window. The first day he came up here, I didn't even move in the house yet. There was no furniture, nothing. He ran through the window, Lou Jr. So that's, you know, that's a long time ago. Yeah. But Lou turned out to be probably one of the warmest people I knew. See, because Lou had a kind of a, I guess he had a little chip on his shoulder, you know, because I don't think he thought that people really appreciated him. They did, especially his peers, because they all knew what a great singer he was, you know. But I guess he didn't figure he was getting from the public. But Lou, I remember when he came up with the idea for the UNCF, and it was because he didn't get the education he wanted. He wanted to make sure other people did. And I was happy that I was able to do, I did maybe 25 of those with him, at least 25. And it was such a pleasure that when we would be in airports or walking in the store or something, kids would come and say, Mr. Rawls, say, I want to thank you. And he would thank me for me being able to get an education. And say, isn't that the guy with you? That's that bad guy, right? You know? Yeah. But I mean, it was such a, you know, that's what you live for, you know. We all want to make a few bucks and everything, but you live for those moments where you really feel you've done something. And Lou created that. He created that whole thing out of his need to help people. And it wasn't need to help people, not just a want to. He had a need. He wanted to do something for somebody else, because he, as he began to get his dues, you know, he wanted to make sure he passed on. And not to be people like that, you know.
Well, you know, I used to see Lou Rawls open up at the Adams West before he had big Adams West. It used to be called the Kabuki. It opened at 2 a.m. I think they went to 6, mm-hmm. And Lou would be the opening act, and he was not appreciated, not because he couldn't sing, but because it was so late. And if it would be Lou Rawls, then it would be the Temps, Lou Rawls, then Coltrane, Lou Rawls, and then somebody. So I used to see poor Lou Rawls just get he would be singing his tail off, but, you know, it was 2 o'clock in the morning. People say, "Look,
yeah.
I want to see."
And you know, Lou was cool. So you know, when you didn't act a fool, people don't notice you as much.
Right.
And you know, the guys in his time period were with the Johnny Watsons and the Larry Williams, those kind of guys who danced and jumped around, James Brown, who in their own right are fantastic. But it was different, you know.
Blue was laid back.
He was laid back, but once you listen to him, you realize he had no soul. Boy, let me tell you, was
well, Lou Rawls was a he had a voice for radio in terms of, and he was very literate in terms of knowledgeable about certain aspects.
Because he read a lot, and he traveled a lot, and he observed and he learned.
You're listening to WhoRadio.com, voice of the International African Revolution.
On April 6th and 7th, Burning Spear Media will hold our annual fundraising radiothon. We are the
Burning Spear Newspaper, Uhuru News, Uhuru Radio,
bringing you news, music, analysis, and information every week. We are your media,
telling the truth about your world,
the truth you won't get from your local newspaper.
We need your support to survive and grow.
Tune in April 6th and 7th for our two-day radiothon. A live online radio and video broadcast
with 20 hours of special guests.
Liberate your media with your dollars.
Africa is on the rise and the future is black.
Building that's been put